You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. And globally at WPVMFM.org.
Well, howdy, buckaroos and buckarettes.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Sky's increasingly cloudy here for today. The chance for a few showers late in the afternoon. Our high temperature near 48. Breezes start to pick up 15, 20 miles per hour. And overnight tonight, right on through tomorrow evening, a high wind watch in effect. We will see temperatures falling back to 23 tomorrow morning. Winds picking up 25, 30 miles per hour, gusting up to 50 at times. And tomorrow, a sunny, very windy day. The high 30. Winds could gust over 50 miles per hour. I'm Bob Kukin on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Narve. Today, once again, I'm going solo. I've always had guests on my show, but lately I've enjoyed exploring different topics solo, so I'm going to do that again today. I've been experimenting with different topics. Last week, I talked about how to write a memoir when you don't know what you're doing. This week, I would like to talk about how to perform and read poetry and other text. I've talked about this in the past. Today, I'd like to go a little bit deeper. I've been airing this show for 10 years on WPVM-FM and 4 or 5 years on KCEI Cultural Energy Radio in Taos, both community radio stations. Community radio gives me an opportunity to experiment with different approaches, as I'm doing now. For many years, I opened the show the same way I open this show today. Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. In the past 2 or 3 months, I've dropped fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm not exactly sure why I decided to leave it out. Maybe I thought it was a little too poetic. Maybe I thought people wouldn't understand it. Maybe I thought I just didn't need it. I might have read something about podcasts saying, don't put too much in the intro. But I really like it. I like it because it is poetic. I also like it because it brings me to what I want to discuss today, how to read your work aloud, how to engage emotionally with your work. What does it mean to find your voice? What does it mean to use your voice spoken aloud as a way of editing your work, as a way of going deeper into the material you'd like to understand or get to know better? How to develop a relationship with a piece of work by reading it aloud. You meet something new, you want to know about it, you hang out with it a bit. So reading aloud does more than just amplify your voice over the room. It gives you a way of mirroring back your own emotional atmosphere and hearing how you feel about what you're encountering on the page. So let's come to fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. So where does the term fertile ground come from? Why would I include that in the intro? It comes from a poem written by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. The poem is titled Kubla Khan. Keep your ears open for the reference to fertile ground. So here it is, Kubla Khan by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. In Xanadu, did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, where Alph, the sacred river, ran through caverns measureless to man down to a sunless sea. So twice 5 miles of fertile ground with walls and towers were girdled round, and there were gardens bright with sinuous rills, where blossomed many an incense-bearing tree, and here were forests ancient as the hills, enfolding sunny spots of greenery. But oh, that deep romantic chasm which slanted down the green hill athwart a cedarn cover, a savage place, as holy and enchanted as e'er beneath a waning moon was haunted by woman wailing for her demon lover. And from this chasm, with ceaseless turmoil seething, as if this earth in fast thick pants were breathing, a mighty fountain momently was forced, amid whose swift half-intermittent burst huge fragments vaulted, like rebounding hail or chaffy grain, beneath the thresher's flail. And mid these dancing rocks, at once and ever, it flung up momently the sacred river. 5 miles meandering with a mazy motion through wood and dale the sacred river ran, then reached the caverns measureless to man and sank in tumult to a lifeless ocean. And mid this tumult, Kubla heard from far ancestral voices prophesying war. The shadow of the Dome of Pleasure floated midway on the waves, where was heard the mingled measure from the fountain and the caves. It was a miracle of rare device, a sunny pleasure dome with caves of ice. A damsel with a dulcimer in a vision once I saw. It was an Abyssinian maid, and on her dulcimer she played, singing of Mount Abora. Could I revive within me her symphony and song? To such a deep delight 'twould win me, that with music loud and long I would build that dome in air, that sunny dome, those caves of ice, and all who heard should see them there, and all should cry, beware, beware, his flashing eyes, his floating hair, weave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honeydew hath fed and drunk the milk of paradise. And that was Samuel Taylor Coleridge's poem, Kubla Khan. And you may have heard the reference to fertile ground early in the poem. So twice 5 miles of fertile ground with walls and towers were girdled round. Well, that's the reference to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. Of course, Twice 5 Miles Radio is also part of the reference to Kubla Khan. I think Twice 5 Miles might be about 25 square miles. So twice 5 miles of fertile ground with walls and towers were girdled around. I did the math. I think I'm close with that. So what that really means when you're telling your stories, when you're throwing yourself into whatever it is you're trying to do, like this podcast that I'm recording right now in Manila. It's around noon. It's on Tuesday. I have an overhead fan going. The sun is slightly coming in. It's very warm here. Manila is always tropical temperatures. So I'm recording in a very warm room, and I'm reading as well as performing this poem. I've had this poem memorized for many, many years, and yet even though I've had it memorized and can say it relatively fast, I stumble a lot, don't quite get all the words right. So I'm doing a blend today of reading and performing and exploring what it means to speak the words out loud. One thing it means when you speak your words aloud, when you read the words aloud, you're guaranteed to have two things happen. One, the words are amplified across the room in sound waves. And two, you're bound to be messy because speaking is a very messy proposition. We stutter, we say, we say like this, like that. Some people pause. Some people get embarrassed. Some people aren't quite sure what to say. We fill our language with all kinds of mistakes. How many times have you said, gee, I wish I hadn't said that? And sometimes saying the wrong thing can get you into trouble, and that's happened to all of us as well. It speaks to the range our voice has when it is spoken aloud. And with that kind of potency, with that kind of power, it makes complete sense to use the voice in your creative work, to read your written work aloud, to read other people's written work aloud as well. So when you're reading aloud, it cues your improvisational sensibilities. You can be reading a line that you've written and suddenly something will pop out that you didn't expect, and you will say it with no thought at all. And when you say it, you realize it fits quite well with what you wrote down. So not only does reading aloud allow you to hear what's going on, it also gives your whole body, which is your instrument, an opportunity to compose on the spot. And those compositions that happen on the spot are happening from a deep well of creativity that's built into your body. It's that deep information that's coming up from somewhere. You don't even need to know where it's coming from. A lot of people will say it's coming from the outside. The universe is speaking through me. That might be true. It's probably a collaboration between the universe speaking and all the deep stuff that is housed within you. So whatever it is, however it works, when you speak it aloud, like I'm speaking now, something emerges, and when it does, it's worth giving it full due and giving it full credit. In his book, Western Wind, John Frederick Nims tells us, a poem comes to us first as speech, on sound waves that register as barometric changes against the drums and gauges of the ear, an apparatus so sensitive it takes notice if the pressure against it varies by one part in 10 billion. A breath of the mouth becomes a picture of the world. Everything that has ever been thought and willed has depended on a moving breath of air. My goodness, a moving breath of air. Everything depends on that. When you frame your spoken words from that point of view, and you think people have been doing that for millions of years, it really does add some depth and breadth to this idea of the spoken word movement. You often hear people say the spoken word movement. They refer to the poetry slam, the open mics, poets reading their work at literary festivals or at conferences. And even though everybody I know understands that the spoken word didn't just start in 1950 with the beat poets, speaking poetry aloud, speaking your words aloud, singing, how long has it been with us? It's been with us since the beginning. That's why it's important to connect to your own voice. How do you find your voice? People often say in our writing workshops, I'd like to find my voice. I can't find it. And I've said this many times on this show, and I'm going to continue to say it. You don't have to find your voice. Your voice is right there. All you have to do is speak it aloud, and there it is. No looking necessary. Funny, if it is breath, you can't see air anyway, so why look for it? But you can hear it. You can feel it. You can experience it. And that's really important. Singing. The voice is your song. And however that voice comes out, the song is very, very important. You may have heard a fair number of poets and writers announce they don't perform their work, they only read it. And when I hear people say that, I respond very simply by saying, if you have one person in front of you and you are speaking aloud, you are performing your work. Maybe you're performing it in a way that bores that person who's listening to you. Maybe you're performing it in a way that makes the person stand up and cheer. However you're doing it, if you have someone in front of you, you're performing. And in fact, I wouldn't even go further. If you're in an empty room and you're reading your work aloud, you're performing because you're asking your body, the instrument, your creative instrument, to perform what it was naturally designed to do, which is express itself. So whenever you read your work aloud, it's important to acknowledge this is performance. Now, the only way to actually read your work on stage and not perform it, or read your work anywhere and not perform it, is to simply open a book and read silently. When you're reading silently, you're not performing orally. You're reading silently, which in a way is a performance. Imagine if you film somebody for 5 minutes just sitting on a park bench, quietly reading silently. You'd have a piece of art, perhaps. Or at least you would have a record, a bit of citizen journalism, recording what this one person is doing in that 5 minute time frame. Is it performance? I think probably it is. So when you're doing anything with your voice, you're performing because you're asking your entire body to participate. And when your body is participating, if that's not performance, I don't know what is. And I said it a moment ago, I'll say it again. You don't have to find your voice. It's right there. You were born with it. All you have to do is open your mouth and speak. Your voice comes out. And your voice is probably one of the most prized parts of what your friends value about you. I've often had people say to me, gee, I wish I had recorded my mother's voice because I'd love to hear it again. I miss it so much. You may have had that experience with people who are gone now. It's one thing to say your voice is unusual or different. It's another thing to really sink into the truth of it. Your voice has never existed before, nor will it ever exist again, no matter how many people come and go. 8 billion people on Earth right now, or 7 billion, I don't know how to count them all. Your voice is unique amongst those billions, and so too, everyone else as well. And so as you start to value your voice more and more, it gives you more confidence to read your work aloud. It gives you more confidence to show up and let your speaking voice lead the day. Show who you are. Allow people to hear what you're thinking, hear what you're saying. Be present with you in your communication. And indeed, when you stop and think about it, that's what it's all about, communication. Your voice is about communication. So why not lean into it? Use this asset that you've had all along to your advantage and to the advantage of those who hear you when you speak. There is truth in what you say and how you say it because your voice belongs to you. This brings me around to an issue that exists in American culture and beyond American culture, and it's the issue of verification. How many times have you been in a conversation with someone and they've said to you, in all seriousness, I don't know who to believe. I don't know what to believe. And that's a legitimate proposition because there's so much out there that's being generated that has artificiality built into it. Artificial intelligence, I'm referencing that, absolutely. I'm a fan of artificial intelligence. I like AI. I use ChatGPT all the time. I use it as an assistant. I use it as a helper. I don't use it to compose my shows. For example, what I'm doing right now, I'm standing at my desk in Manila recording this show as I go. I'm not reading from a script. I am doing it off the top of my head, and yet I trust my organizational abilities to put a show like this together so that it will have a narrative through line. This has absolutely nothing to do with ChatGPT or artificial intelligence. It's coming absolutely 100% from my imaginative, intelligent interior. Everything that's inside of me, all of my emotions, all of my thoughts, all of my ideas, I'm capturing with my voice as I speak aloud. So the same thing is true for you. When you read your work aloud, when you say what you mean, tell people what you're thinking, it's uniquely yours. You can verify it, and it's easy to verify because you're speaking it. Nobody else is generating this. And even if you're reading something that's generated, a script, you still bring all your emotional tones to it, all your truth to it. So it's important to remember that as we talk about how to read your work in public, how to read the poetry, how to stay conversational with it, and to trust that showing up and being messy has a great value. And you can trust that value. So once you start to trust your voice, your confidence will grow. Now, if you've read your work in public before, or if you've given some kind of speech before, and you've done it a few times, you've come to see how much fun it can be. But if you haven't done it all that much, and you are just beginning to start to work with it, it's understandable. You're going to be a little nervous. It's a brand new arena. It's a training that requires focus, attention, practice, and rehearsal. Allegra Houston and I wrote a small little pamphlet, I guess you could call it a book, titled How to Read for an Audience. She and I wrote that about 4 or 5 years ago now, but the principles in the book still apply. So here are 10 tips from our book, How to Read for an Audience, that you can use right away. If you're a seasoned presenter, you'll still be able to use these as a reminder. If you've never approached it like this before, then hopefully these will be valuable for you. So here they are. Number one, read for emotional connections, not for correctness. So a good reading isn't about getting the words right. It's about transmitting your feelings, staying connected to that emotional atmosphere that's always there, that emotional atmosphere that makes you who you are. Number two, your audience is not the enemy. Your audience is there to take the time out of their day, their night, to enjoy what you do, to enjoy the experience of storytelling, of communication. It's not about success or failure. It's about community gathering together. Number three, take your time. The pause is one of the most powerful assets you have. When you allow silence to be in the room as you're presenting your work, you create opportunities for the audience to relax, for the audience to readjust, for the audience to wrap their heads around what you're saying, for the audience to take the time to allow meaning to bubble up inside of them and to give them a bit of a breather. Even to this day, after all these years of being on stage, I still speed up, and you can hear that in my voice. Sometimes on this show, I get very excited and speed up rather than slowing down like I'm doing now and taking my time. Number four, rehearsal is not optional. Rehearsing frees you to be present rather than trapping you in some kind of text dilemma that you don't feel like you can get out of. The rehearsal is the place where all the mess happens. Keep it messy. You'll hear acting teachers say that. Keep it messy. Keep it messy. If you're crying, cry. If you yell, yell. If you throw a chair, throw a chair. Just don't throw it at the people in front of you. Throw it to the side. Number five, choose less material and read it more deliberately. Read it slowly. Read it with the intention of allowing who you are to float underneath the lines. Choose less material. You don't have to say a lot, but when you do your rehearsal, what you say can have great weight. A shorter, well-read piece creates more impact than too much content. A good example of short content would be the shortest poem ever written, or one of the shortest poems ever written, on the antiquity of fleas, Adam Haddam. I know it's a joke, but you get the point. Number six, stand still. Stillness creates intimacy. When you ground yourself physically, it helps your audience relax and lean into what you're saying in a deeper way. It's hard to stand still. It's hard to not move your hands. And yet when you rehearse, practice that. Hold them down to the side. I once tied myself to a chair when I was rehearsing A Child's Christmas in Wales because I moved too much, flapped around like a bunch of birds in a flock. Number seven, look at the audience. Make eye contact. Eye contact turns your reading into a shared human experience. And eye contact doesn't mean you stare. It just means you look out. You take your time because you're going slow, taking it easy. You take your time to actually see the people, to actually recognize them. When I first started performing, the first time I walked out on stage, long, long time ago, I looked out of the audience and I got dizzy because all the eyes looked different and I didn't expect that. So once you adjust to it, it becomes easier and easier. Now, number eight, when you can, use personal stories. And use them sparingly, use them truthfully. Like I just told you a personal story about the first time I performed and how dizzy I was when I saw all the eyes. So feel free to be honest, to put your stories out there, and people will appreciate it. It gives them confidence. Nervousness is energy. Number nine, nervousness is energy. It's not a flaw. What feels like fear can become focus. You can intensely focus what feels like fear on where you are in the moment. And it brings everybody alive. People appreciate that. And here's the best one. Number 10, reading aloud makes you a better writer. When you hear your work spoken, you can hear what's going on. Sometimes when you're speaking your work aloud, you can change it in midstream. Why be attached to the page? Even if you spend a lot of time getting it to the point where you think it's perfect on the page, when you speak it aloud, your speaking voice might have a different opinion. So these are the 10 things that you can do. There are a lot more, but I think these 10 are quite useful to start applying. And if you're listening to this on community radio and you're not quite sure what I just said, you can always email me, nave@janesnave.com, and I'll be glad to send you the 10 points. Nave is spelled N-A-V-E. One of the reasons I'm recording this show and talking about reading poetry aloud, because a couple of days ago I came across an article by Gregory Cowles in the New York Times titled, "What's with that voice people use when reciting poetry?" And he opens with this, "It's been described as embarrassing, cliched, or unhelpful sing-song. Many poets dislike it too, but it's a style they've learned from each other." You probably noticed in the title, reciting poetry rather than performing poetry or reading poetry. Those three terms, performing, reciting, reading, in literary circles are often used interchangeably. Reciting suggests you have it memorized. Whose woods these are, I think I know as houses in the village, though. Performing suggests that you're putting some theatrical elements into the work. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. That would be overperforming or overacting, actually, but you get the point. And reading would be more, whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. A fourth term you very seldom hear in literary circles, telling, which I love the idea of telling a poem, like telling a story, rather than performing it, reciting it, or reading it. It's a bit like, I'm going to tell you a secret. I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to tell you something you've never heard before. Like I said, I prefer the idea of telling a poem over the other three. So here's my version of telling Robert Frost's poem, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Whose woods these are? I think I know. His house is in the village, though he will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there's some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but I have to keep and miles to go before I sleep. And miles to go before I sleep. That was Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost. One of the reasons attempting to tell a poem rather than read it, recite it, perform it, or declaim it. This may not be true for everybody, but when I tell a poem, I'm allowing myself to connect more deeply, not so much with what the poem means, but what my relationship is becoming with the poem. So in a sense, you come back to performance. My telling is a performance because, as I said earlier, my body is performing. The same is true with someone reading the poem. Body is performing as well. The person reciting from memory is also performing. And of course, when you get into the highly charged up performativity part of the spoken word opportunities, people are really performing because they're throwing everything into it. Oftentimes, when you get that highly charged activity going on, you negate some of the subtle emotional aspects of connection in favor of the big, big things that people do in order to keep the audience's attention. Now, each choice is a creative decision. One's not necessarily better than another. If you loved the highly charged performativity of something and that's where it takes you, fine. If you're more inclined toward the telling like I am, then you move in that direction. I have to say though, of all of the categories that I've talked about, the reading with a neutral, non-connected kind of way is for me just absolutely over the top boring when I'm sitting in the audience, listening to somebody stand at the microphone. Usually you can't quite see them because they're holding their book in front of their face. Often they'll step up to the microphone and tap it two or three times and say, can you hear me in the back? And then they read with no voice projection at all, even into the mic, and you still can't hear them in the back. And yet those folks who take that approach never depart from it. It's always predictable. It's always going to be the same. And if you go to a literary reading and one of those types of readers show up, you pretty much know what you're going to get, which is basically a bad performance and a boring presentation. And I believe because the folks who do that just simply aren't willing to take any kinds of chances. And what is most interesting when you are in front of a group of people, and this is the hardest thing to do, it's to take chances. And I don't do that as much as I would like to. I wish I could tell you that I take chances all the time. I tend to hide behind my own persona very often.
and I end up maybe boring the audience as well. So what I'm talking about here is as much aspirational as it is practical in respect to how I go about things. I'm lately getting a little bit better at it, mostly because I do these podcasts and also read the work aloud and record the work and put it out online. I'm not doing as many public performances, which is a very, very different thing. Public readings can be a great deal of fun. You have to understand that when you are up there on that stage in public in front of the mic, you mostly have some control. You can control the pacing. You can come early. You can feel the room out. You can rehearse like crazy. And yet when you get up there in front of that audience, you never know what will happen. Maybe a Harley-Davidson motorcycle will rev up right outside in the middle of your most sublime comment. Maybe somebody will fall out of their chair. Maybe somebody will decide they really disagree with you and they'll start to heckle you. Or conversely, they really love you and they may decide they want to come up on stage with you and share the moment with you. I've had that happen to me before. And you have so many variables in a live performance. That's what makes the live performance that you do unpredictable, interesting, and certainly very often messy. And mess is currency. I've said that many times. And I think it's what we come for, to see people experiment. And in some ways, every time you go into the public to read, to perform, to recite, to tell, however you go about it, it's going to have a little bit of mess involved. And that's what makes us human, really. And it's also important to keep in mind when you are moving in the direction of speaking your work aloud, have confidence that when you do such a thing, it's very powerful. It's powerful because it changes you. It forces you really to look at your own ego and how you get in your own way and what kind of obstacles you create for yourself or solutions to what you perceive as obstacles. One obstacle you probably have some experience with, most people do, perfectionism. I want to get the thing right. And when you're on stage speaking into the microphone, that little gremlin that sits on your shoulders, that little internal critic that's somewhere inside, maybe living on your liver, who knows where the internal critic lives. All those little voices are telling you, you've got to get it right. Now, the problem with this, my friends, nobody really knows exactly what getting it right means. So shall we speculate? Perhaps getting it right might mean, let's just allow ourselves to be who we are on the stage without much fuss or fury or any of the rest. I'm thinking of many years ago when Asheville Poetry Slam was quite popular at the Green Door on Carolina Lane in downtown Asheville. This was back in the 90s. This was back in the days when the slam poets were really experimenting. They were quite full of performativity. I was one of those. I had no idea how to do it. I stumbled around quite a bit, and I was always projecting my ego, projecting my image, trying to make the point. I was indicating quite a bit. Look over there. See that? That would be indicating. I'm not seeing anything. I'm just pointing at the stove and saying, look over there. And I did a lot of that back in those days. There was a woman there, her name was Maverick. And one of the things that Maverick did that I always was impressed with, and I didn't really know how she did it. How does she do this, I wondered. What she would do when she did her slam poetry, and slamming poetry doesn't mean you throw somebody down on the stage and jump up and down on them, slam the poets down. No, it means can you connect emotionally at such a level that the audience responds to your emotional connection the same way a stadium responds when the team hits a grand slam and you win the World Series or some other series. So Maverick would always step up on the stage. She generally had a piece of paper with her. She didn't have the poems memorized. She would make sure that she put a stool out and she would settle into the stool and she would read her poems. Probably had them memorized, but she kept referring back to the paper. And she did it in this fanciful, joyous, interactive way, allowing us as the audience to watch her explore whatever the topic was that she was exploring, and she would win the slams. All the rest of us, we were yelling and jumping around and being highly performative. Maverick, sit down, perform her piece, and get high scores. And it took me a long time to realize the reason why the judges responded so well. Judges are arbitrarily chosen from the audience, five of them in the slam, and the MC or the house manager chooses the judges. So you never know who the judges are going to be. But when the judges are consistently giving high scores, that tells you something is happening emotionally. And because Maverick would sit there and allow her emotional experience to happen in front of the audience, judges included, and when that unfolded, people were pulled in by Maverick's invitation, her openness, and they were able to connect emotionally to the ideas that she presented. It didn't really matter what her category was. She always did that, and I always admired it, but I was a bit of a coward, really. I was a creative coward, perhaps, a poetic coward. I was so intent on impressing the judges that I didn't impress them. I would often get poor scores. And I just simply wandered around very often thinking, how do you do that? Now, all of these years later, I'm still asking those same questions. And I find that even though I probably would never be able to get the high scores on the slam stage, my style is just not slam style. But I am able to connect emotionally in a way that delights me. And if you were in an audience and I happened to be on stage, my goal would be to let my ego get out of the way and just connect easily with whatever it is I'm presenting and invite you to watch it happen. Same thing would happen if I'm in the audience and you're on the stage. If you could do that, I would lean in and listen to you like everybody else in the audience would. So that leads me to think perfectionism is actually allowing yourself to simply be yourself on stage. And actually, you could take it off the stage and put it into any circumstance. Just be yourself and listen to what the other people around you have to say. And you can listen to the audience or you can listen to an individual, and it's all the same. So Maverick taught me a lot. I'm just now really understanding what she had to present. She was never trying to teach, but she taught by example. And I also came to learn over the years, after having done thousands of shows, many of the shows I did overact in, I learned the whole point of working in a performance situation, a reading situation, rehearsing, developing the piece, getting to know it, letting it get to know you. The more you do that, the more you understand about the text, but even beyond that, the more you understand about yourself. Where are those little hidden avenues that you can go down, or alleys, or little corners that you can get in that you didn't know were there? Corners that maybe will offer an emotional nuance that you haven't experienced before. Where is all that? It's inside your imagination. What is it inside your imagination that keeps surprising you at odd moments when something is given back you didn't know you had had in solitude, spontaneously, and with great joy? That's a line from a poem Charles Wright wrote. Lonesome Pine Special is the name of the poem. So how do you apply all of this to the work that you are doing? My creative collaborator, Allegra Houston, and I have a regular Saturday gathering, 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern time. We call it the Imaginative Storm Writing Prompt of the Week. It's on Zoom. We usually have 27 people who show up, and they switch out, so it's not always the same people each time. It's always free. It's a loosely configured writing group. And the reason I bring this up is because the people who come onto this call generate a piece of writing in 10 minutes, longhand. And then after they generate the piece of writing, we do it by prompts, so it's a fairly easy thing to do. So after they generate that piece of writing, they get about 150 words, maybe a little bit more if they write fast, a little less if they write slowly. They all go into Zoom rooms and they read the work. And what I've noticed about the reading time, every person who reads speaks it as if it's coming from a conversation they're having with themselves. They never perform. They don't get into that performativity kind of indication. They're not doing the sing-song thing the New York Times article was wondering about. Why do poets sing-song? And I will say this about the sing-song stuff. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though he will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. It's a faux reach into something that feels important. Maybe they read it like that, and I'm being a bit dramatic, but you know what I mean. It's methodical. It's mechanical. The stakes are high at a reading. You want to be noticed. You want to be thought of as an important poet, an important literary figure. Important. You get in your own way when you do that. On our Saturday calls, there's nothing important about it. It's not really throwaway. It's just, hey, now it's time to read the work. It may be a little bit clumsy. It may be a little bit sloppy. But hey, let's read it. And let's read the work from the page that you've written it on. And the page is longhand writing. And usually people have a difficult time sometimes reading their writing. So they will just do an improvisational bit in between what they can and they can't read. All of that renders itself quite easy to listen to, quite intriguing, like looking at a fire or looking at a fish tank or watching the wind blow through the trees. So when you are preparing yourself to read your work aloud for other people, the best way to do it is to start simple, start easy, read the work aloud, no pressure, just see where it takes you. So I would like to give you an idea of how I develop a piece. So I'll offer a piece that I wrote this past Saturday in the Saturday group that Allegra and I host. So the way it works, we see the image, jot some words down, and then play off of those words to generate a piece of writing. We usually build from a prompt, which is often just an image. The image we used last Saturday was the image of old-time musicians playing Appalachian music, and also an image of my father, who was an Appalachian fiddler. So in terms of a presentation, in terms of telling a poem, you have to start somewhere, and the place you start is just simply reading the work without an agenda. I do keep in mind that I will eventually memorize these pieces. Doesn't mean that I'm that stuck on the word for word thing, but it does mean that over a period of time, I will go over it and over it until eventually I'll just know it and I won't have to look at the paper anymore. Or now the screen or the iPhone, depending on what kind of device you use. And yet the text is important on the page because the page has a geography that allows the text to sit there in all kinds of forms, which you make the call as a poet and as the creator. How do you want it to lay out? So here's the piece I wrote on Saturday. I'm going to tell it. We'll see how it turns out. It's called Mrs. Hyatt's House. I wish I could tell you how to hold a fiddle, or why your fingers belong on the string alive air, full of new moments, headed to old memories and sad endings when the endings come. I wish I could tell you who played in tune and who was on bass. I wish I could tell you how to hold a fiddle. These secrets belong to those who are gone, left the world, forgotten, behind. I'm without sound tonight here in Manila. Silence that includes names I wish I could remember. Silence that includes songs I do remember. Listen to the men, mostly men back then in the 60s, standing late at night in the Westgate parking lot. Trucks backed up, cases open. The French Broad River below, going to Tennessee, headed into foam in next year. Hold my fiddle, and I will tell you to love me. Frankie and Johnny said that. The moon must have hung above the parking lot. Stars certainly hung there. Time didn't hang around. It was busy chasing the French Broad River. I wish I could tell you how to hold a fiddle. Let's praise for a moment and say a prayer. And then holler loud, it's midnight, it's midnight. I was a boy when I first held a string.
old men with sad stories dropped in and out, and then in and out again. Love was there. A train was there in the story. Hear it coming, orange blossom special, coming around the bend. God help me, there's always a bend in this story, and a father, and men I won't remember. Old goats, all of them, mostly dead now, as the river will remind you. Come, let's hold the fiddles together. Hear the music. The old men are gone. The music remains.
That was Mrs. Hyatt's house. And Mrs. Hyatt's house actually was on Brevard Road, and it was a famous gathering place for Appalachian musicians, my father being one of them. And I went there many times myself, and a lot of people in Asheville managed to go to Miss Hyatt's house over the years. Like I said, it's gone now. A car dealership took its place, but the memory still remains. And that's the whole point of generating this work. The memories remain. What will I do with that little piece of writing? I put it in this podcast. Maybe I put it on Facebook. Maybe I submit it for publication. Maybe I make a little movie out of it. There are a lot of things you can do with the text. And since my father appeared in the poem I just told you, I'd like to now tell you another poem. This poem is about a father. It was written by Dylan Thomas. You may know this piece. It's relatively well known. It's titled, Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. The wise men at their end, no dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning. They do not go gentle into that good night. Good men, the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men, who caught and sang the sun in flight and learned too late, they grieved it on its way. Do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death, who see with blind sight, blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of a light. And you, my father, there on that sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. So that was my telling version of Dylan Thomas's poem, Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. So that's one style, telling the poem. You have another approach, perhaps? Whatever your approach is, I encourage you to experiment with it. I'm recording these pieces. Obviously, this is recorded because you're listening to it. So I can go back and listen to what I said. And I will say that when I re-listen to these pieces that I read, I'm fairly satisfied with them. But I hear things I'd like to do. I think, oh, it's not quite right. Even after all this time, I'm still worrying about getting it right. So it takes a lot of practice to get yourself away from your ego and get into just having a bit of joy while you're telling your story or your poem without any concern about what's going to come next. Just the moment, right now, this is what's happening and this is how I'm telling it. With that in mind, here's another poem I wrote during one of our Saturday sessions titled, It's Raining in Georgia. To whisper requires grace beyond secrets, beyond tender hearts. We've all lost love, dropped into black holes, called out late in the night, love me, mama. Warm memories arrive with mosaic questions. I've lost love and gained love. Someone wrote a country song once, sad thing with a small stream running by an old house where two people lived out their lives no longer bright. Those two were Wilma and Sam. Along the road that goes to town, where a few stoplights dangle, and an ice cream shop sits beside a newsstand. This couple belongs in a country song. Yes, grace matters, and so do Friday night football games, wars in the distant past that made men who live in this town now older than they should be when they came home young and hoped for love. If you write a country song, include me, add my story to your roster. Make me a small part of something larger. No clowns, please. The whispers you hear when you dream belong in this song. Your lost loves belong in this song. Too many times I've wandered alone without the night to call our own, far away from where we belong. Too many times we've wandered alone. Include me in your country song. Make a place at the table. When I knock, let me in. By the way, it's raining in Georgia. I added the raining in Georgia part because I've always loved the song, It's a Rainy Night in Georgia. So when you can, if you can toss a song reference into a piece you're writing, it might give it a little bit of flavor. A little word of caution, though, do not put song lyrics in your poetry. ASCAP is very serious about that. If you put song lyrics in what you write and you put the song lyrics verbatim like they were written in the song, ASCAP can come along, especially if you publish it or put it online. They can come along and charge you full usage rate for that line. It's quite an interesting little proposition. So the best thing to do if you're quoting music, to do something like, well, it's raining in Georgia, isn't quoting it's a rainy night in Georgia, but everybody knows that's the sensibility I'm going for when I say it's raining in Georgia. Also, mentioning Georgia sets up the country vibe a bit, maybe sets up the idea of how something like my 10-minute timed writing could be possibly turned into a country song to add music to the piece that I told you just now. The point here is to say that all of the material, the content that you generate, can be taken in many, many different directions. I'm currently teaching a creative writing course titled Write What You Don't Know. It's divided into 10 sessions. We meet each Tuesday. We're moving to the fourth one next Tuesday. I've taught this course many times. And one of the questions the participants always ask, well, what do I do with all this work that I've generated? I've now generated this work. What do I do with it? Where do I put it? And that's a really good question to ask. And what I say to these folks, I say, put it wherever you want. You could put it in a box and put it under your bed, or you could bury it in your computer and nobody will ever see it. Maybe that's the job of the written piece. Or you could take it in the ways that I take it. I'll generate a piece longhand. I read the piece out loud from the paper, the messy paper. And as I'm reading, I'm also recording it on my smartphone. And as I'm reading from the mess, if I feel like adding something improvisationally, I throw it in. So once I get the recording, I transcribe the recording and I use artificial intelligence, a transcription service, to get verbatim what I've said. From there, I take the text and I go through it and do some hard edits. Ask editorial questions. Is this what I want to say? Does that work? Does this fit where it needs to fit? And usually it fits exactly right in terms of the narrative order. Sometimes I change the words. Sometimes I take things out. And at some point, I end up with what I am happily able to call a poem. And then I can read it aloud. And from there, I record it like I'm doing now. Sometimes I'll make a little video of it. Sometimes I will ask ChatGPT to generate an image based on the poetry that I've written. And sometimes the images are just absolutely abysmal. Other times they actually work. So I may take a few of those images and pair them up with the poems and push that out as a YouTube video. So there are lots and lots of ways to do this. And then, of course, these little bits all fit together into a bigger show if you'd like to make that happen. So I eventually will take all of these 10-minute timed writings. Each runs out to about a minute or a minute and a half to read, and I'll put them together in one piece. I'll memorize it, and maybe I'll do a spoken word show with it. Now, there are a lot of ways you can go about this. The most important thing to remember, when you are working with your content, the stuff that you generate, remember to stay wide open to the things you can do with it, how you can present it. There are no restrictions here. The only restrictions, your creative sensibilities or the limitations that you think you might have about what you can do with it. Some people throw it at the wall. One of the participants last night said, I don't like to throw stuff at the wall. I like to spend a long time editing. My comment was, well, take one piece and spend 3 or 4 weeks editing it until you really feel like it's up to speed, and then you can put it out. No requirement to put any of this out. You can keep it in the box. Emily Dickinson did that when she wrote all of her poems. Here's one that I will close with, written by Emily Dickinson, just to sorbet the moment and sorbet the close. I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Shh. Don't tell. They would banish us, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog. To tell one's name, the livelong day, to an admiring bog. I'll bet you that Emily Dickinson was talking about all the poets who are telling their names, the livelong day, to admiring bogs. And I was one of those important poets trying to tell my name, the livelong day. And you know, maybe I still am. Hope I'm getting a little bit better on that. And I am appreciative that you've been with me this whole run through the hour. And I'm most grateful that you are here and that you're doing the work that you're doing wherever you are in the world. And on that note, it's time for me to say thank you ever so much for listening to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I am your host, James Nave. Thank you, Walter Parks, for our theme song. WalterParks.com for more on Walter's music. Devin Dial, thank you for managing WPVM-FM in Asheville. And Robin Collier and Mike Tilley, thank you for managing KCEI, Cultural Energy Radio, in Taos, New Mexico. If you'd like to reach me, Nave at JamesNave.com. You can always reach me there. Nave is spelled N-A-V-E. You can also find the link to our Saturday gatherings. If you'd ever like to join our free little romp on Saturdays between 12 and 1 Eastern time, doors always open. Love to have you. Like to hear your voice. Like to hear you read and find out more about what you're up to. So with that in mind, the only thing I have left to say is I appreciate you tuning in. I do hope you come back sometime very, very soon. And until then, maybe, just maybe, if I'm lucky, I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
Carlos Santana,
it sounds like you've always felt that music is a healing force and you've become more and more out about that to the general public.
I want to grab that part that you just said from the OJs. Music is the healing force of the world. You know, I love music, you know. But there's a part in there which says music is the healing force of the world. See, that's what we need to constantly broadcast in radio. You know, how music, mystical medicine music, heals a twisted, crooked world.
Oh, man.
There it is.
We need the medicine now more than ever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's there. And all we have to do is just turn it up.
She had to do was move her pretty feet and do the low yo 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 yo. All right, baby, do your low yo yo with all your stuff. Now, baby, do your low yo yo stuff.
in your beanie. Whether you're long, tall, short, or skinny. Sometimes it's rough. You mean to tell me it's that low yo-yo stuff? Low yo-yo-yo-yo-yo.